I never forgot in my whole career, our Air Force, our Department of Defense service people are so dedicated and determined to succeed and do what's right. And that's something you never forget. And you always take a lot of pride in. Even today, people say, well, what do you miss about flying? I said, it's not about flying. It's about these dedicated men and women that I served with that were so special. And you just don't get over that.
Welcome to the Tango Tango podcast. Real, raw, and unfiltered conversations with veterans and those who support them. Tune in, be inspired, and walk away stronger.
Welcome to the Tango Tango podcast. I'm your host, Lloyd Knight, and this podcast is brought to you in cooperation with Supply Chain Now, who produces and distributes. Thank you, Scott and Amanda, for allowing me to do this wonderful thing. Joining me is one of my commanders from way back in the day, a four-star general retired, John Handy. Welcome, sir.
Thank you very much, Lloyd. Really appreciate being here.
It was so exciting when I was looking at guest list for this, and you know, I put together a list of 40, and General Handy was number two at the top of the list. One, he's an airplane guy, and I love airplane guys. But two, I really admired him. I had the opportunity to work with General Handy twice in my career, once at Headquarters Air Mobility Command, and then the second time with UPS, where he provided some consulting service when we were knee-deep in serving the warfighters in Iraq and Afghanistan. And I really enjoyed both opportunities, both very different opportunities from each other, but enjoyed that. So so congrats for being so high on the list, sir.
Well, I appreciate that. And knowing that you're in charge of the list, that makes me feel real good.
Awesome. So, General Handy, where'd you go to high school at?
I was born and raised in Raleigh, North Carolina, and it's rather unique at that time that it was the only high school available. So, Needham-Broughton High School in Raleigh
was the only high school available. Wow.
Yeah, so, that's exactly right. You keep in mind that this is a long time ago.
I finished my career at Seymour Johnson Air Force Base as a first sergeant in Goldsboro, North Carolina. And so I spent a little bit of time around Raleigh. But Goldsboro won the Best Small Community Award in, I think it was 1986, and then they quit trying. So I really liked the area, but I was not going to retire in sleepy Goldsboro. So you ended up living back near home now. How far away is it from hometown?
It's probably only about a 2.5-hour drive. I live in Fort Mill, South Carolina, which is just, it's almost like a suburb of Charlotte, North Carolina. And it's an easy drive over there. And I have nobody left in that part of the state. I've been there a couple of times just to attend different events, but it's a different town than when I lived there. I should say city.
Yeah, I bet. So you went to Methodist University. So how'd you end up picking the Methodist is in Fayetteville, if I remember right?
It's sort of unusual. It was Methodist College when I first became aware of it. It's become a university now, as many of them have. I went from high school. My first year, I wanted to be at a big university, and so I decided to go to UNC, University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. Spent my freshman year there. Absolutely. Don't anybody pick on me about Carolina now, but I hated that year. It was awful. Little John Handy, and you know, I had 450 or 500 students in my zoology class. I never met the professor. There was a graduate student teaching, and it was that sort of overwhelming experience. I went home that summer and told my mother and dad, let's find something else. And my mom came up with this idea. This relatively brand new school, Methodist College in Fayetteville, went down and interviewed, and the rest is history. 4-year degree in history, 3 there and 1 at UNC. So 3 great years at Methodist University, 1 miserable year at UNC. It's a great school. I just wasn't cut out to be in that gigantic environment.
So why'd you pick history as a major?
That's another, you'll laugh. I was in my first semester of my senior year, and my counselor called me in. They said, John, I was president of my class, by the way, so I wasn't, boring. They said, you need to pick a major. You're going to be graduating pretty soon. This is early in the semester. And I said, well, what do I have the most credits in? And they flipped through some pages, looked up. Well, it's history. That's my major. in fairness, I really enjoyed history, liberal arts stuff, philosophy, religion, all that sort of stuff. There was no way I could survive in a mathematic environment. And so I'm a history major. So I love that. A BA in history, an NFS in systems management, and an honorary PhD in humanities. So
yeah, I saw that. So, we're going to fast forward a little bit. How did that honorary PhD happen?
Well, I really enjoyed methods and always kept contact. And when I was promoted to my first star, the school president at the time invited me back to give the commencement address for that graduating class. And so part of that was a surprise that they had done some research, and I'd been volunteering for the United Way and a bunch of stuff, as a lot of, colonel commanders do for their local communities. And I was a wing commander at Charleston Air Force Base. And so we had a great campaign that year. And so they, quite frankly, came up with some remarkable reasons that I should have a PhD in humanities. And I was quite happy, but it was kind of unusual to be there in my dress blues and one star on my shoulder, and they're putting all this garb on me and anyway, honorary PhD, which I'm quite proud of. I don't diminish that. No, but people really went out of their way to pick a guy like me to honor. I mean, there are hundreds more that deserve something like that better than I did, but I was quite pleased.
Yeah, it's very special. So you graduate with a history degree. Did the Air Force calling come right away, or did you have a break?
Well, my senior year, I'd always been interested in flying. As a kid, I joke with people, I say that the doctor, when he slapped me on my back, Buster had wings in his hands, because I couldn't think of anything as a young man, little boy, but airplanes. I made every model airplane. I had them all in our room, hanging from the ceiling. I would read books about aviation and flyers, and I would draw things in a little notebook about flying. And so I always had that feeling that perhaps I could try to be a pirate. And as I was approaching my graduation date, probably 4 or 5 months from graduation from college, I decided to just call a recruiter, and I got referred to one in Fayetteville. You can imagine what they thought. 1966, and this kid wants to join the military. Vietnam was blossoming, but I really wanted to see if I could do it. And they sent me to your alma mater, Seymour Johnson Air Force Base, for a flight physical, and I passed it and signed the paperwork to go to officer training school after graduation. It turned out to be an October report date in San Antonio, Texas, for OTS.
Wow.
And then from there, as a second lieutenant, right to pilot training. So I really lived my passion, and there's just no doubt about that. Very blessed.
And you went to pilot training where at?
Webb Air Force Base, Texas.
Okay.
It's not close to anything. But it was great. It's middle of Odessa, not far. The nice sort of oil towns. But the beauty of Webb was, it really was out in West Texas. And so the flying areas were wide open for us. And so you could do just about anything you wanted to and not worry about upsetting people on the ground. My first supersonic flight, a T-38, was remarkable in that nothing happens in the airplane, but you do make some noise on the ground that you're unaware of. But it's a big spread. It was great. I spent a year there.
So were the did you fly in T-37, or was that predated?
Yep, it was went from the Cessna 172, which is that first little thing just to make sure you don't get airsick on takeoff roll. And then the T-37 tweet, as everybody called it, and then the T-38. And it was great. It was a remarkable experience.
I got a buddy flight in the T-37 when I was in flight test at Wright Pat. What I remember, beside being a blast to fly, was, wow, was it hot. It didn't have much of an air conditioning system.
No, and you're sitting side by side, and if I did something wrong, the instructor could reach over and, slap me, and it was, quite thrilled to get in a T-38, either front or back seat, where you could fly and not worry about who's sitting there next to you.
So it's so now pilot training's done. Again, we're in the midst of the Vietnam War. What was your first aircraft?
The first thing I did was, there was a long list of aircraft available, and I had great flying skills, but very poor in math, as I mentioned from college. And so the educational part of pilot training for me, to be honest, I spent an awful long time in study hall after the end of the day with an instructor and a group of guys that could fly quite well that couldn't study. We learned an awful lot with hands-on teaching. And so with that history, when you get lined up for graduating, I was, excited. I don't remember now how many people were in the class, but the very first fighter was an F-4, and I didn't want to go be a backseat in the F-4 in Vietnam. And so there was another little trick that a lot of guys are playing, is sign up for a C-78 Caribou.
Yeah.
The deal at that time was if you agreed to go do a year in the Caribou in Vietnam, you'd have your first choice of aircraft when you came back. And so I looked at the Caribou, it was a twisted way of getting to Vietnam, have a ball over there in that airplane, and then come back and opt for something else. So I went through Seward Air Force Base, Tennessee, checked out my C-7A, and enjoyed flying that thing. It was quite an airplane. I never ended up in Vietnam, though. That's kind of the rest of the story, too.
What did that thing cruise speed-wise?
Well, it was interesting because if you open the cockpit window, the side window, you could slide your hand out and not have it blown away, and really wipe on the windshield and slide it back in. That was a trick.
The
instructor would say, look, I put my hand out there, and you do this, and it would. It was a great airplane, maybe 125 knots, something like that. It was
okay. Wow.
It didn't move very fast.
Yeah, I flew the C-23 Sherpa for a while, and it would cruise about 150, and you couldn't go over 10,000 feet. So we would have cars out in the desert that were passing us on the highway.
Still looking down. I'd tell people, you'd come up to, like several crows flying in formation, and you could never catch them.
So what was your first duty assignment with the Caribou?
Well, it's interesting because I graduated, got all checked out, went back to Raleigh to get ready to go to Vietnam. I had port call, all that sort of stuff. And I was driving from Raleigh to Richmond, Virginia to see some friends. And a car sideswiped me off the road. Have no idea, passing, pulled into me. I went off the road into a ditch, long story short, crushed some vertebrae in my back and spent some time in hospital.
Wow.
Back brace, and had to have the doctors call my port date and cancel that. It was a real crisis in my life because I'm looking at a bright future, and now I had no idea. And so I can only thank the orthopedic doctor that I had at that time, had this brace that, I was in the hospital in a very short period of time. I went to a sort of a private place to recover, and then started having people work the Air Force. What do I do? Here's this Second Lieutenant Handy who missed his port call and, in the hospital, all that sort of stuff. I wasn't getting a lot of information, so when I got sort of released from the hospital, I kept calling the offices down at the Military Personnel Center saying, where should I go? And I was getting being nowhere. So I just packed up my stuff, got in the car, and drove back to Surrey Air Force Base. Went in and saw the wing commander.
Wow, really? Wow.
I said, here's who I am. And I don't know where to go. And everybody's just kind of laughing at me. It was a guy named Dick Gibney.
All right.
Colonel Gibney. And it was probably the, you know, divine. He was the only guy, I think, on the planet who would care and did and treated me just magnificently. Had people get me into the match options quarters. Had this brace on. There was a major in the room next to me. He actually helped me put my shoes on in the room. It was, wow. You know, big joke with the guys. And it ended up in assigned me back to this Caribou squadron that I just trained in months before as like the guy in charge of their command post. And so here's this second lieutenant, Andy, you know, keeping track of the Caribou flights and the training. And the squadron commander was a great guy. And I mean, it had a significant impact on my early life as a second lieutenant and then first lieutenant there. Behind the scenes, I was still working to try to get back on flight status. I spent almost a year grounded before same Colonel Gibney got me to the right place for checking me out and x-rays. And, oh, you know, you're good to go. And I got back on flight status. And I said, I really enjoyed the Caribou, but I've been here watching all these C-130s flying around here. So how about if I check out on the 130? And the same guy, Colonel Gibney, said, you know, Andy's demonstrated how remarkable a young man he is with all his stress. And they put me in the C-130 program. And that's where I checked out.
Yeah, that's what a remarkable squadron commander and wing commander to...
You can't imagine. Yeah. Hank Glover, you know, the back of my head was that squadron commander, lieutenant colonel at the time, and General Colonel Gibney was the wing commander. And he was still there. Uniquely, when I went to Vietnam and came back, I had to go to Little Rock Air Force Base where he had moved the wing from Seward down to Little Rock Air Force Base, Arkansas, and said, I'd like to join that wing again. And sure enough, I ended up back there.
I had a squadron commander who you know, who did something similar for me. I got asked to move from the 437th wing at Charleston, right in the flight test at Wright-Patterson, and I had to get a squadron commander approval to make that happen because I was a brand new senior airman, and that was retired General Ray Johns.
Oh yeah, Ray is a really good friend. He's a really good friend.
He was an exceptional commander as well.
Yeah, he worked for me a lot during his senior part of his career. He replaced me in a couple of places that I'd been in the Pentagon and out in the world. So a remarkable, significant human being, a great person.
Yeah, that's good. So you ended up flying C-130s in Vietnam.
I stayed there for a very short period of time, and it was typical back then. We just were finishing a mission, local training mission. I'd already checked out and was assigned to one of the squadrons here. And we got off the crew bus and we were met by somebody from the personnel that says, I have ordered to Vietnam for ABCD. And there were, I think there were probably 10 guys on the bus. And six of us had orders for Vietnam right then. There was no advance warning or here's what you want to try this or that. So we said, okay, here we go. And that was my introduction to getting assigned. And by the way, I'd been married about between 16 and 17 months when I was sent to Vietnam for a year.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, for a year. And where'd you go in Vietnam?
I was sent to Taiwan in the 50th Airlift Squadron.
Right.
And we were full rotations at Cameron Bay first and then Saigon secondly because of the numbers of Americans in Vietnam. This was a way of, I won't say hiding, but put squadrons on Taiwan that were supporting the Vietnam missions. And so we go down to either of those two bases, Cameron to start with for 25 to 30 plus days. Bank hours and then fly back for a little release at Taiwan and then come back. So you could have a week or 10 days back there and back to Vietnam. And most of us weren't be in Vietnam flying. It was a remarkable experience when it came to.
So now you're young pilots in war. What were some of those leadership lessons that you learned that would serve you well as you moved up the ranks?
Well, I think in that environment, every crew member on the aircraft I flew, as well as back then it was all men, to make that point. So I'm not being prejudiced when I say all the guys or all the men. There just weren't any female pilots back then. But everybody was working so hard to do things right. And nobody had to tell anybody what to do. It was your flight engineer knew exactly what he had to do. Your navigator, the load masters, any other pilots you were associated with. And they were determined and dedicated to get the job done. None of us enjoyed being there deep in the hearts because all I had family back home, as you already heard me say. And there were a few bachelors, but most everybody cared about their family, but we had a purpose. And it doesn't matter about, rewriting your history of Vietnam, but we knew what we were told to do, asked to do, and we were there and committed. And you don't forget, I never forgot my whole career. Our Air Force, our Department of Defense service people are so dedicated and determined to succeed and do what's right. And that's something you never forget. And you always take a lot of pride in. Even today, people say, well, what do you miss about flying? I said, it's not about flying. It's about these dedicated men and women that I served with that were so special. And you just don't get over that. So in that environment, you learn that, you take it home, and it stays in your heart your whole life.
Yeah, I echo that. I don't think I miss flying on airplanes that were built in 1961. not the most comfortable things in the world, but wow, I miss the crew dynamics for sure. I miss, leaving the home base where sometimes things could get mundane and dysfunctional, then going out on the road and just gelling, sometimes you knew the other crew members, sometimes you didn't, but normally you would gel and do these exceptional things. And sometimes you would be fragged to be out for 2 days and you're out for 3 weeks. So I would often tell my late wife that they made us do this, honey. But most of the time it was the crew going, yeah, we want to stay out for a little bit longer. So and so I really miss the people. I still, even being retired now for 18 years, I miss the people. You just can't recreate that.
No, you can't. And I'm blessed that a lot of them still stay in touch. And my contemporaries, we episodically and periodically get together in a not so formal environment. And it's refreshing. It's enlightening. And that's not to say that the people in the world I've lived in for the last almost 20 years in the commercial world, I retain that same relationship, very special with a lot of the people, perhaps not as at risk for sure, but dedicated and determined to succeed. And so my life was built on those almost 39 years of being an Air Force pilot and hand-to-hand, arm-in-arm with my contemporaries. It made life so special.
So now your year is over. So where do you go after Vietnam?
Well, I went back to Little Rock for that same year. Colonel Dick Gibney was the commander, and spent almost 4 years as an instructor pilot, stand-up pilot at Little Rock before I was selected to be an exchange officer with the New Zealand Air Force.
Wow.
Because they still have the same five C-130s in their fleet as I flew from early 74 to late 76. And so when the assignment person called me, they said I'd volunteered. Years before that, I would agree to be an exchange officer. Something came up. And they said, New Zealand. And I said, okay, that sounds okay, but where is New Zealand? And today everybody knows, but then, pretty naive about it, I guess, New Zealand? Okay, sign me up.
Well, that must have been glorious for you, because I know you're an outdoorsman, and you know you love nature and animals. So and where did you go to in New Zealand?
Well, Funuapai Air Base, Phenuapai.
Okay.
If you got it.
Even for you to say.
Funuapai. So WH is always like H. So Funuapai Air Base, which was a little bit outside of Auckland, New Zealand, on the North Island. And so we bundled up. It's kind of funny because my wife and I never had any kids. We adopted our daughter in Little Rock, Arkansas, in January of 74. We'd just gotten her. This assignment came, and I had to call and say, you know, the people that at the state level, you know, I'm in the Air Force. We got this kid. You're not going to be able to supervise me for a year. Do you want it back, or do I get to keep her?
Really?
they were laughing too. They signed everything, and so we went, from January to April of 74, brand new baby, 2.5 days old when we got her.
Wow.
And then we were off to New Zealand. So by the time we came home 2.5 years later, she was a proper little Kiwi. That's for sure. Except there are no other Americans. And so it was a wonderful assignment. You mentioned the beauty of the country, the kindness of the people. There were no Americans at all. I was the only one. Oh, and the embassy people. It was great. We were able to travel all over the island. They were encouraging us to see the real New Zealand, and it was remarkable. We flew, every mission was you're in, flaps up, and you're over water.
Yeah.
So it wasn't like, we flew some local flights for check rides and that sort of thing, but it was a remarkable experience.
Well, my current country count is 75. And then my new bride and I went to New Zealand, South Island, for a honeymoon a year ago.
Oh, nice. And
I can tell you it's top five. I thought it was absolutely glorious.
It was one of those experiences that are just sort of burning your life. I still get emails from some of my squire mates from all that long time ago. You know, it's interesting. The guy that I exchanged with, I was the New Zealander that came to my squadron there at Little Rock. I went to his squadron, the only one of C-130s in New Zealand. He ended up being chief of their air staff, and I ended up being the vice chief of staff of our Air Force. And so how in the world would you ever think that in 74, two people that exchanged positions would end up where we did?
And you need to bottle that water.
Yeah. New Zealand as often as you can.
Yeah, pretty glorious. And so what was next for you after you returned from New Zealand?
Well, let's see. New Zealand, I went back to Travis Air Force Base in the maintenance career field, which started my logistics
career.
So I spent 3 years flightline maintenance at Travis Air Force Base.
Yeah, that's always unique in the Air Force. You take pilots, and you put them in command, and it's a sink or swim for sure.
Well, it wasn't a command. I was a captain.
Oh, he's still a captain.
I had to go to Wright Path to get my maintenance education.
Okay,
I hadn't been near.
All right,
it was real sort of in your face. Get out there, but I loved it. It was really, it was so different and interesting from my time anywhere else that I thoroughly enjoyed it. I was promoted to major there. I did intermediate service school while I was there, got my master's degree while I was there. And so it was very much a career broadening that I probably couldn't have done much of that if I'd still been flying full time, in a squadron, Sandoval or whatever the case may be. And so it ended up being a great assignment, a real learning experience, put it that way.
Yeah, I think my time, so I was, an aviator for most of my career, but I ended up going to the Taosi in Ramstein, the AMC Taosi, and stepping out of the airplane for 4 years was pretty glorious. And I often say it re-blued me, and it made me a much better leader than if I would have ever been if I would have stayed in the Air Force.
Well, it was. I agree. At that time, there were way too many pilots in the Air Force. It's hard to believe. They need everybody they can get. But so we were put in these ground assignments for career broadening, and it turned out to work to my benefit because I got all the other stuff done. I've been flying. I don't think I'd ever gotten to where I am. I know I'd never have gotten where I am today without that particular assignment. It was just a unique experience.
Well, you and I have something in common. We both flew the C-5. Were you qualified on the C-5s?
No, I never did. Yeah. I was watching launching them and wishing them good luck.
Yeah.
From a maintenance perspective, it was a challenge.
Yeah, especially at that time, you know, the C-5As with the pneumatic systems they had were creating some big issues with the Air Force for sure.
I'm not picking on them, but we would follow each aircraft out as it taxied. They're all the way you were. We'd follow it out in a big vanned flight-wide vehicle with maintenance troops on board, and me is just learning and watching as they taxi out to make sure they at least got to the runway and took off. Watching with binoculars, I'm not exaggerating, with binoculars, to see the gear go up, and it's like, we can go back to the squadron and start working on the next one. The gear was a major problem in that.
I mean, whoever thought of doing everything pneumatic wise, which is instead of hydraulic. Fascinating. Yes. So you spent 4 years at Travis?
Three.
Okay.
So those assignments were all 3 years.
Okay.
And from there I went to Pope Air Force Base in Fayetteville.
All right. And back in the C-130 or?
C-130s as a young major and then lieutenant colonel there. And it was a great time for a young guy like me who had been through all that and back to the airplane that I loved in an environment that got me back to North Carolina where, my home was there, as you mentioned, in Raleigh. And it was a good time to be that close to home with parents.
And was that your first command?
I was in the C-130 squadron, and a maintenance, the OMS back then, organizational maintenance squadron guy, got canned. I mean, for lack of a better word.
Yep.
And I got a call from my boss that says, you've got a maintenance experience. The Wing Commander wants you to take command of the OMS. And that was a little harsh because I was having a ball in the squadron doing flying and giving check rides. And so I said, okay, salute smartly, went and was the OMS commander for the rest of the time I was at Pope.
Yeah, I always said that there's only two people who really know what's going down in the squadron. That's the commander and the first sergeant.
That's right.
So, the people that have no idea what everything is going on behind the scenes. So how many people were you leading at that time?
I don't remember, Lloyd, but it was, organizational maintenance was 200 or 300 maintenance types that took care of almost everything. Because maintenance in those days was divided into three. OMS, FMS, and the avionics squadron, AMS. And so it was the fun of sort of a last touch before you launch aircraft. And I learned a lot, again, about what I've been doing at Travis with the enlisted side of the house. But that experience really helped me understand sort of the leadership role that I had as a squadron commander. It was just a great experience. I ended up getting promoted, and it was one of those just a great learning experience for John Andy.
Yeah, very, very good. And what was next?
Well, I went from there to as a lieutenant colonel, and I promoted 2 years. You don't get below the zone promotions nowadays, but 2 years early to lieutenant colonel, and to the National War College.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so that's a year long?
It was a year long, a great year. Met a lot of people, learned an awful lot about things that weren't just the world that I'd lived in at that time, but just a great experience, and was promoted to colonel 2 years earlier while I was there too. So
okay, wow.
Yeah. So it was shocking. Ended up in that time frame, that it was 83, 84 when I was at National War College, and just learned a lot, but also remarkably promoted way ahead.
Yeah.
I've been up here in November of 84, which
is
100 years ago from today.
Nah, so I joined in 87, so it wasn't that long ago. So you become a wing commander, your next stop?
Well, after National War College, I went to the Pentagon.
Okay.
Lieutenant Colonel promoted me.
Okay.
And we graduated in the May-June time frame. So went to the Pentagon in the logistics world, spent about a year there, then was asked to move to the programming world, which is the money manipulators. And I thoroughly enjoyed that and learned an awful lot about our Air Force, how you fund it, how it gets done. I was what they call a panel chairman of the logistics side of the Air Force, money issues. And so I did that until assignment time came a year or two later, and ended up back at Hope Air Force Base as the what would be now the ops commander, but the DO, operations back when I was there, at back to Pope.
Great. So how many years at Pope?
I got back there in 87 time frame. By 89, I was called to a week's notice to get to Rhine Line, because the then 21st Air Force commander and the MAC commander were leaving as in fired again, the wing commander and the base commander at Rhine Line.
Wow.
And so that 21st Air Force commander, Major Don Leger, flew a C-141 a week later, picked my wife and myself and a dog and a couple pieces of luggage, and we flew to Rhine Line, landed on Thursday, Friday morning as a change command.
Yeah. For those viewers out there, you got to understand, Rhine Line was just the hub of it all. And it was a very busy place. Yeah, it's weird to go there now, because I actually stayed in the old aircrew hotel, which is now a civilian hotel.
That's right. Yeah. There's no sign of Rhine Line anymore.
It's odd. But yeah, it was a happening place, and Desert Storm would kick off not too long after you got there.
Well, I was there 89 and 90.
Okay.
So 1 year here, Handy fixed this list of problems. And I went there thinking I'd be there 2 to 3 years.
Yeah.
And so it was a wonderful assignment. Again, I learned an awful lot. The people that worked with me were remarkable. I could fly a C-130. I checked out in C-9. Which was a medevac aircraft. Then I got a call.
Another call.
Good thing, the wall came down while I was there. So that was kind of between East West Berlin. So a lot of history took place in that time frame. And we were extremely busy. But then I got a call from General Leger again. They had relieved the wing commander at Charleston. And he was going to fly in with an airplane, pick us up again, and fly to Charleston. So we got there in, March time frame of 90.
Yeah.
Here's this C-130 pilot, maintenance guy, coming in to be the one wing commander at a C-141 strategic airlift base. And I can't imagine what they probably thought with this. This guy coming in he's going to run things. It was funny to me by the time I got home every day at the looks I would get in staff meetings, great people. One of them ended up being a four-star as well, so he must have learned something.
Who was that?
I'll keep it quiet for now. Just
yeah, so interesting enough, I was in the 20th Military Airlift Squadron there at the time, and I, as you were arriving, I was headed out the flight test to Wright-Patterson.
Well, so it was interesting, because I always spent 89 and 90 at Ryan Mine in 1991, and then by two, I was up at MAC headquarters as a brand-new one-star select. H.T. Johnson, who was, I was trying to think of.
Yeah, General Johnson. Yeah. Well, you couldn't
keep General Roger.
You couldn't keep a job, sir. Holy cow.
It was meant to fix it. And I always said that I'm a warm and cuddly guy, but maybe was able to get people to do stuff. But they did. Folks at Ryan Mai and Charleston were incredible. Officers and enlisted, were doing everything right. I mean, they really were, and made me look good. I guarantee you that.
So now you are a one-star general at Headquarters Air Mobility Command. Did you ever picture yourself when you were miserable at the University of North Carolina studying zoology that you'd be a one-star general?
Oh, no. I mean, all I wanted to do when I joined the Air Force is fly airplanes. That's all I've worried about. And at that time, if you were a major in a squadron flying, you're the happiest guy on the planet. And so I just really wanted to fly. And you put me in an airplane, let me fly. And so you would never in your remotest, wildest dreams think that you'd get past major. And a lot of my contemporaries, most of them, when we came back from Vietnam, I hesitate to say it, but there's this organization called Federal Express in Tennessee that was hiring them to fly overnight missions all over the United States. As I thought about it, but that's when that phone rang and you can go to New Zealand. That's why I said, Memphis, Tennessee. Let me think about that. So,
spectacular.
Anyway, fast forward. So I never dreamed I would end up where I ended up being. There's no doubt about that.
So how many flight hours did you end up with?
Just over 5,000 spread between the C-130, the C-141, C-7, C-9, as I mentioned, the Caribou, and that's been the KC-10 when I was a three-star at McGuire Air Force Base at 21st Air Force Commander. That was a joy to fly. It was a big, huge thing and fun, but primarily airlift aircraft. I was given joyrides in F-16 and F-15 so I could relive my time at final training and my dream of one day being a fighter pilot for airlines, but I'm living my dream on airlines. I could get up and walk around. I could have a cup of coffee. I could have...
Hey, go to the bathroom.
And I threw the G5 and the C-130, my last assignment as the dual-hatted guy at Sky Air Force Base.
So I'm pretty sure I know this answer already, but what was your favorite aircraft you flew?
The C-130.
Yeah.
That's it got me through Vietnam. It got me through almost every crisis you can have in an airplane. It was just so reliable. All the rest of them were too, but it's just, you spend that much time and you love the crew members you're flying with. And there's just a passion in that airplane that's hard to beat. And it's still flying today. Not the same one, but I flew E's, H's, all versions, and J's before I retired.
And it's not going anywhere. So,
no.
Yeah.
It's the C-47 of the modern aircraft. Yeah. It really is.
Yeah, it's an amazing aircraft. I never appreciated it being a strategic guy and had the deadhead of the several times. So it was a little bit too slow.
Those seats are just not human beings.
Yeah, not at all. So now how many assignments did you do in the Pentagon and how many total years?
Let's see, I was there as lieutenant colonel and a colonel, and then a 2, 3, and 4 star.
Okay.
But not consecutively. It was just in and out, in and out. And so I never added up the years, but it was plenty of time, and I enjoyed it. A lot of people complain about the Pentagon assignments, but I enjoyed being a part of that big picture universe, you know, of not just Air Force headquarters, but in the Pentagon, and to interface with my service counterparts of the Army, Navy, Marine Corps, build friendships that way, understand what they're doing and how they're doing it, and the civilian leadership that we had at the time. Every one of those assignments were, you know, a different person and all those, you know, particularly the political nominees. But it was just great to see, get a good view of that world before I went back down for my last assignment at Scott Air Force Base. That was good.
So you made it from one star to four star. You know, our viewers, if you're not familiar with the military, it's really extremely rare. There's just not a whole lot of four-star generals. Who was your mentor? Or you probably had several that helped you really go from one star to four star.
I ask that, though. People ask me that routinely, and I don't point to anybody as a mentor so much as I do those people that I admired and learned a lot from. Gerald Cassidy, you mentioned earlier, is a remarkable person. He did a lot for a lot of people in the command. He, by way of making MAC at the time what it was, he was the first commander, you know, of the Joint Transcom and Military Lift Command, as we called it at the time. And their subsequent commanders were very unusually highly talented people that earned the respect of all of us. And so mentor is one word, but it's who you admire as a young person looking up, and you want to try to emulate the things that they're demonstrating in terms of their leadership style, their decision-making capabilities, how they treated the people around them, their equals as well as the subordinates. And there are a lot of them. A.C. Johnson was certainly one that I admired and watched. Ron Fogelman is still just a remarkable individual. So you look at these people and you say, they all mean something to me personally and professionally. And so as you never expect to be promoted. As I mentioned, I pinned on colonel in 1984. I didn't get my first star until 91, 92 time frame. And so that's a long time to trudge along. And I just was blind to the years. I just wanted to keep watching guys and, you know, on top of me and try to do good. Then one star, and then 2 years later, two stars. I was surprised about that. And the three star was, wow. And then I tell people, nobody gets promoted as a four star. And so how do you do that? There's no way you can say, I want to be a four star. This is how you do it. It's one of those miraculous events that, little John Handy ends up as a four star on Air Force. Absolutely miraculous.
So between one and three star, what was your favorite assignment?
I think my time in the Pentagon as a two-star, I really learned perhaps the most. I was back in the programming business, and I was the programmer then. And so I had the opportunity to learn about the financing mechanism within the Air Force, within the other services, how we come together, the visits that we have to make on the Hill to try to win friends and influence people about Air Force programs, up here at Harriers, to defend programs, be able to brief Air Force programs to all the four stars in the Air Force at the time. We would come together, all of them, each of them having an agenda for their demand for funding, and then briefing them the end results. I learned probably the most I possibly could as a two-star in that environment. And that carried me through, I think, the rest of my career, that time, and how I was treated and how I learned, and then being exposed to remarkable people during that assignment. And then I got the third star, went to 21st Air Force as a 21st Air Force commander, and was there for a very short period of time, brought back to the Pentagon by General Fogelman at the time to be the chief logistician for the Air Force. and did that for a couple of years before, lo and behold, you're going to be promoted to 4 stars. You're going to be a vice chief of the staff of the Air Force. And nobody was more shocked than that's your culprit to you. I can tell you that.
So who was the chief of staff that you served under?
That was General Fogelman.
Okay, General Fogelman.
But he was gone. He was gone well before then.
Okay.
Mike Ryan was that chief that ended up being, promote me. And then John Jumble took his place. And that's when I went back out to 9/11 happened.
Yeah.
And then by October, November of that year, I was on at Standard Force Base as the Air Mobility Command and the Transcom Commander.
Were you the last dual-hatted?
I was. I tell people all the time. Yeah. I did it as a 4-star by myself, and they had to replace me with 2. Yeah, 4 stars.
So the for those listeners or viewers, so at there was 2 commands at Scott Air Force Base. So you had Air Mobility Command, which takes care of all the cargo aircraft, the air mobility, and then you had the Transcom side of the house. So Air Mobility Command was Air Force, Transcom was all the branches of service.
Right.
You had Air, Rail, Ocean, and the so General Handy was the last 4-star that actually did both roles, and he had 2 offices. In buildings that were right next door to each other, which was kind of fascinating. How was that a 50-50 split, or were you spent more time on Transcom?
Well, if you look at what was going on in the world when I got out there, we'd hit 9/11. Everything was ramping up to prosecute that terrorist attack. And so it started out that I thought maybe I would spend maybe half the time at my Air Mobility Command office, and then half the time at Transcom, as you mentioned, U.S. Transportation Command. That quickly became one where I spent most of my, but thinking and working on the Transcom side, because we were, as you mentioned, we're responsible for everything that moved in the Department of Defense, air, land, and sea. And so it meant rail, buses, planes, ships, our own internal assets. And it's everything that moved, people, sandwiches, the whole spectrum of things. And at that time, roughly somewhere around 156,000 people, if you counted the Guard Reserve components, everybody that reported to the Transcom Commander, to include the assets I had in the Air Mobility Command. So you end up spending a significant amount of time in that environment. The other thing that's important, I think, for the viewers to understand is that Air Mobility Command reported to the Chief of Staff of the Air Force. It was General Jumper. The Transcom Commander's boss was, at that time, the Honorable Don Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense. And so my real communication, my chain of command, was to the Secretary of Defense, not to the Chief of Staff of the Air Force, not to belittle that role. But it was one of the reasons I pressed to replace me with 2 4-stars, because I always felt like the Air Force Chief of Staff needed the full attention of the Commander of Air Mobility Command to work those air issues for airlift and air refueling and air medical vac and the presidential airlift by the folks at Andrews Air Force Base. That was that role, and I felt passionately about that. And also knew that in a wartime environment, I had to spend a lot of time focusing on global logistics. No matter what happened, it wasn't just the Middle East. It was a typhoon hit somewhere, and you got to rush supplies. It was an earthquake or the conflicts in the Middle East or anywhere else. And so those two roles demanded the full attention of the people that were ultimately responsible. And Secretary Rumsfeld agreed and supported that initiative to separate the command. And so the name I didn't mention before, sitting around the conference table at Charleston Air Force Base, is Duncan McNabb.
Okay.
Duncan took over the role as the AMC commander, and General Morty Schwartz took over the command at Transcom.
Yeah, I had a front row seat for that. So I got to Scott in February of 2002 and spent 18 months in TACC, working C-21 and C-130 deployments. And then I moved over to staff where I was the functional manager for the TALSEs, which they now call CRGs. And to your credit, it never looked like you were absent 50% of the time. So I don't know if they cloned you or what.
It was the greatest opportunity I've ever had. I mean, there's no doubt about that. Loved what Air Mobility Command was responsible for, what they could do. And the fact that it was active duty Air Force, Air National Guard, and Air Force Reserve components that made it all happen. And it was not a Swiss watch, because there's nothing that we do that is that precision. But it was as close to a Swiss watch as you can imagine, because of the dedicated people that made it happen and just determined to see it work. And so that environment at AMC just had a life of its own. The world at Transcom was, look at all the components to Transcom that did all the work that needed to be done and made it happen. And I could be there and get credit for all the work that they were doing. There's just no doubt. We had such amazingly dedicated people in those years, and they still are there. It's just that I was blessed to be served by some very unique individuals.
To your credit as well, I love the way that you interacted with the enlisted force. I near the end of my time at Scott, went to Airlift Tanker Association, a social at the All Ranks Club, and me and one of my buddies, a flight engineer, the late Jeff Seidels, actually he was a boom operator. We were in the club, and just the two of us, we got there early, and you came walking in, and they were like, oh, holy cow. and you walked right up to us, and you warmly greeted us and asked us what we did. And, that made quite the impression. So it's a kudos to you, because not all senior leaders are like that.
I appreciate that. You learn a lot when you grow up. And as I mentioned earlier, it took me a long time to get to where I was. And there are probably only three or four people in modern Air Force times, my contemporaries, that served as a four-star as long as I was blessed to serve. So from 2000 until I retired, early 2000 until I retired in October of 2005. I mean, it's 2005 is, you normally get 2 years and you're toast. And I just didn't know how to say no. And so, it's a broken record. I know people would be tired of hearing that. But you have to imagine how unique and how blessed you are to serve in those roles and those positions and be able to get things done and see people do things right and throw themselves at the problem and make it happen.
So it's a
plug got me here today. See,
it did. So we'll talk a little bit about that. Because I think I'm going to share some info that you might not know. So 39 years, you retire after 39 years of service.
It would be, if you count the time I showed up at OTS, which was October of 66, to when I retired in October of 05, yes. But if you look at the Air Force record, it says commissioned service. So I was commissioned in 4 January 67.
Okay.
And so it's like 38 years, and then do the math. But I know full well I put a uniform on for 39 years and loved every day. Except for maybe a couple.
Yeah. Oh, there's always a couple, right? So you spend that long in any sort of authority, you're going to have bad days.
Well, I tell people routinely, I mean, this is true. If I look back at my entire life, I never had a bad day my whole life, because good days and bad days are an attitude.
Okay.
I try to help people think, if you look at life, every day is a blessing. Every day is such an opportunity. And so things can happen. But if you finish the day and say, I'm still here, you ought to have a big smile on your face when you crawl in bed and say, you know, I've just had another really good day. And you look back over life and you say, it's not naive, it is an attitude. And so I'm trying to force people to think that way about life. And it's a blessing.
Yeah, God bless me with another day. Amen.
Yes.
So 39 years, because we'll go with 39 years. And you retire. Hopefully you took a little bit of a break before you went on to your next.
Well, people ask me that routinely, but the retirement ceremony was on a Thursday or Friday. I mean, you were there, you should know.
Yeah.
And then on Monday, I started work with the company that wanted to hire me in a little ship operating company in Charlotte, North Carolina. So I agreed to go, leave my home there outside Scott Air Force Base, which we had moved into, by the way, and moved to Charlotte in 2005. So, it was a short time that I had off. It was a weekend, essentially.
I made the same mistake. So I had my retirement ceremony on a Friday, moved with my late wife and two sons to Atlanta on a Saturday and started with UPS that Monday. So, but then off and running. So you're off and running again. So your first role with this, it's not a small ocean company. It's actually, they do some phenomenal stuff. And I don't like all ocean companies, but that one I like. So,
So you are talking to me now. So yeah, you're going to say that, but
no, there's
well, here's the thing. See, the company that hired me in Charlotte was a small Jones Act carrier.
Okay.
Yeah. So I also was hired as an advisor.
Yeah.
Because I don't like the word consultant. If any consultants out there, but advisor sounds more, because I could walk in, provide my advice, take it or leave it, and I had no agenda. So the company in Charlotte got me into the shipping business at the same time the larger company that you and I are going to talk about, perhaps. That's a remarkable company. I've been with them, as I said earlier. It'll be 20 years in October, and they're remarkable. In between, though, I had all kinds of connections to include with UPS and dozens of other companies that would be willing to ask me to come look at stuff and do what I can do to help them out.
So I got to tell you, this story, I'm not sure if I ever shared this story with you. So UPS decides to hire an advisor. I was really, really happy with it. Our previous advisor it had been so long since he was in the Air Force. He was no longer of great value. So our sales department put together this list, and they send me the list, and I was like, who in the world are these people? Great. I'm like, this general was fired.
You're talking about.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm like, they were really naive. They thought every general could be influential, and they were really hiring for influence versus knowledge. And it would very, very, very naive, like, right? And so I was like, none of this. I was very arrogant. I was a brand new director. I'm like, none of these people work. Don't waste our money. And so they're like, all right, smart ass. Give us the your top five and you're number one on that list. So I don't know if I had ever told you that. So
I think you did tell me that one time. Well, I was about to get mad at you for something, and
you didn't get mad at me.
And you know where?
Yeah. So that's the I tell that story oftentimes now, which is just hilarious.
But one of the most enjoyable things that I did on the side was that time, working with the people at UPS who were just remarkable individuals.
Yeah, you actually made my life a lot easier by educating the sales leadership on the contracting process, on the way things worked. I mean, we my role at UPS at the time, we were significant, and I won't talk about revenue, but I can tell you, we moved 5,000 armored vehicles to and from Afghanistan. So we provided about 20% of the intra Middle East airlift. So I was working 60, 70, 80 hours to make this happen. I got promoted three times in my first 5 years up to the senior director level, and was making it up as I went along. For you to come in and really ground our sales leadership, and I think you pretty much said, hey, don't listen to him all the time, but like 70% of the time he's okay.
There was a great experience. So I look at those days and months and years with a lot of pride, frankly.
Yeah, me too. I never want to do it again. I'm happier in my role in managing the military and veteran talent that we have. You know, we have 19,000 veterans that work for us at UPS, making us one of the largest veteran employers in the world. So I do immensely enjoy that. So let's talk about your this Ocean company as well. So you're now the chairman of the board.
I've been the chairman for quite some time. You know, as I mentioned, I've been with them. It'll be 20 years in October. An American roll-on, roll-off carrier. They operate very large ships that are not container ships. They don't have cranes still on them. When we pull one of these ships up to a dock, it's just like all the other ships outside. But a very big ramp comes down the stern of the ship, and it's enough of an angle that it meets with the dock. And it's these things are aircraft carrier size. Ocean-going ships. There, most of them have 10 hydraulically operated decks inside, and everything that comes over off, as the name of the company indicates, American roll-on, roll-off carrier, is everything rolls on and rolls off. But so you can hire about a 24, 26 person crew that operates a ship, and then the loaders are all the unionized workers ashore, and they know exactly what they're doing. Perfectly. And they roll that stuff on, whether it's military equipment or BMWs, Fords, automobiles, privately owned vehicles, what we call big and ugly stuff, John Deere equipment that you can load the decks higher, then you can lower the deck to get more room above it. Most of them have four decks below the order line, six above. And occasionally we'll even put some stuff topside, but not preferably. And they're amazing ships, amazing crew, both officer and what I would call the enlisted, which you and I would understand, crew members. They all get together and do this amazing work. Our company is primarily Atlantic-based, East Coast, Gulf Coast, over to Northern Europe. We get into Poland quite a bit with military equipment. We would serve, in my time, the Mediterranean and the Middle East, Red Sea and up, which we don't do for obvious reasons right now. But it's an amazing company that does a lot for the government. Vanscom is one of our major contractors right now, and so are a lot of our commercial contracts. And we're owned by 50-50 Norwegian and Swedish, really large companies that operate worldwide. Walwell, we call them, Wallenius Woods and Lines. And it's something that I thoroughly enjoy. Great people, great opportunities. And we're still serving the U.S. government through our military cargo.
What always amazes me about your ships is the speed of unloading and loading, and then the placement of the vehicles. They're so close to each other.
Yeah, for 20 years now, almost, and we're talking about inches, not feet, and it's big equipment and it's cars. It's just, they know what they're doing.
Yeah, amazing. And how many ships do you currently have?
We own 10. We charter some out. We operate what we need in the Atlantic based upon what we need to carry. And so we do a lot of commercial work, as a lot of U.S. government work. And we operate for just a logistic company. Ships are the main thing. We also run ports for the government different services across the world. And it's just a fun thing run by very talented executives that know how to make this stuff happen.
So we talked about your journey into the Air Force. We talked about your Air Force journey. We talked about now your civilian journey. What do you like to do for fun?
Well, I travel, and I've also thoroughly enjoy hunting of all types and nature. I mean, I have almost as large a passion for nature as I ever had for flying. And just being out in the world and seeing things that I never dreamed I'd ever be a part of when I was a little kid.
You said you've done 17 trips to Namibia?
Well, to Africa, probably Southern Africa, if you count them up. I never was able to do any that kind of stuff while I was in the Air Force. My dad raised me, so I was very familiar with how to handle weapons and how to shoot, and he taught me from a BB gun up to shotguns and rifles. And we hunted a little bit as kids, my dad, my older brother, and myself. Never anything other than squirrels or rabbits. But that planted that passion in my head. And so now, as I sit here, I've been hunting in Africa 17 times. And as I said, mostly in Southern Africa, South Africa, Namibia, Zambia, most of the countries in below the equator. I went to Kenya when I was in National War College to see what that was like, but that was a sponsored trip with the government. But Africa is just such an amazing place, amazing people, cultures, and you'll be changed if you ever go. And anybody out there that didn't believe that, just go, you'll see.
If you can't afford the ticket, join the Air Force.
Or the Army,
You sent me to Hoedspruit, South Africa, when you were at AMC for humanitarian relief. It's amazing.
It's an amazing place. Namibia is probably my favorite. It was part of South Africa for a while. It was German Southwest Africa, and the German influence is still very obvious today with the way that cities are laid out and the government. And just I could go on the rest of the time we're talking with how much I love the people and the culture and that environment. It's just amazing.
Yeah, I enjoyed it too when I was deployed. And so as part of the TALSI, I stayed at the headmaster's bed and breakfast of the local school that was on the Air Force Base. And driving into the Air Force Base, every day was a safari, just driving on into work. It would see so much. And then I had the amazing opportunity to give a speech at this guy's school. And it was a school with black and white children. And I think there was 300 I gave the speech to. And it was remarkable because they had the kids had the silliest questions. If I knew Arnold Schwarzenegger, does everybody carry a gun in the country? Does everybody live in a brick house? And then afterwards, I spoke to the staff and they had the same silly questions. And I thought it was just remarkable that when we showed up, honestly, General, they weren't very trusting of us. And by the time we left 6 weeks later, everybody loved Americans because we came and we represented. They saw how hard we worked to support the flood relief in Mozambique and in Africa. And then the relationships we built. That was 2001. And I still correspond with him. It's pretty amazing. I love it as well. I hope to eventually get back to.
I tell people when they ask me, we're thinking about traveling somewhere with our young kids, that 10 to 13 kind of a time frame before they get in the serious teen years, and you don't want to take them anywhere.
Exactly.
So I say, get your kids there in that range, and you'll have a different human being growing up in your house. Because you get out in the villages, and you get to see what life is like and how challenging and difficult and hard it is. I've been in the middle of nowhere, Mozambique, you mentioned, and way up north, just below the Tanzanian border. There are people that have never seen anybody but all the villagers. And so you come in there, and it's a life lesson right in front of your face. And it's not bad. I'm not painting that kind of a picture, hopefully. It's just such a unique experience that Americans ought to take advantage of. Then when you come home, you ought to appreciate what we have here and complain. My goodness.
Yeah, I agree.
No wonder. No wonder. In Mozambique, we're driving along. We've been, I don't know, 30 or 40 minutes in a car south of the last little village we're in. And here comes this guy with some fish on a string walking up beside the road. And one of the trackers stopped and talked to him in his language. And he says, there's no streams near that village, and there's not a lot of food. And this guy had walked all the way to this river, caught these fish, he's going to walk all the way back. So he'd spent maybe 30 minutes fishing, but it was an all-day affair. So you think about that. And he was happy. I mean, he didn't have complaints, but I felt like we ought to load him up and take him back to the village, you know, instead of letting him go his way. But that's not what they do in that environment. But it was just that tiny thing was impressive to a guy like me that says, you know, no complaints.
Yeah, I mentioned my country count, 75, number one on the list of the United States of America. So we have the best country in the world, with no doubt.
Yeah.
So what kind of closing words of wisdom do you have?
Well, we've discussed a lot. I just certainly want to thank you, Lord, for thinking of me in the most humble fashion to spend this time with you. And I found it refreshing and nice, and hope we can continue to stay in touch. And it gets back to what I said about every day is a blessing. And we ought to be so very thankful that we've got a world that folks like you and I live in. God blessed us really well. And we ought to just smile about that and have a good day every day. And I think that'd be the best I could offer to anybody.
Amen, sir. Hey, I greatly appreciate it. This has been a real honor for me, and I hope we do stay in touch.
The Tango Tango podcast is proudly sponsored by Supply Chain Now. Join the Tango Tango community for more inspiring stories. Follow us on Facebook, X, and LinkedIn. Subscribe to the Tango Tango YouTube channel. And follow and listen to Tango Tango wherever you get your podcasts.